Hello and welcome to the FinTech Australia podcast, presented by Tier 1 People, leaders in FinTech executive search. I'm Dexter Cousins, and in today's show, we're joined by Doug Morris, CEO of ShareSite. But before we talk to Doug, shout out to our awesome partners, FinTech Australia. They're a member-driven organization building an ecosystem of Australian fintechs advancing the global economy. We share their mission to build a strong community, foster connections, and support innovation. To become a member, go to fintechaustralia.org.au. Welcome to the show, Doug. Could you tell us a little bit about ShareSite?
Sure. Thank you very much, Dexter. ShareSite is an investment tracking software solution. So basically, we help investors organize and aggregate their data. We give them performance insights in their portfolios, and we also allow them to run tax reports as well.
Fantastic. So when did ShareSite start?
Actually, way back in 2008. So we're an old startup, I suppose. I'm not quite, but it was started back in 08, 09, right after the GFC or sort of during the GFC by a father and son team over in Wellington, New Zealand. So they ran the business for a while in New Zealand. They kind of bootstrapped it. And then it wasn't until, say, 2012, 2013, where we attracted some outside investment. And that's where I got involved in the business. And then we kind of grow in Australia from there. And now we've taken it to a few other markets as well.
So which markets are you in?
So predominantly, Australia is our biggest market. We're also in New Zealand, where we came from. We're in the UK, Canada, and the US as well. And there's kind of a long tail of other countries where you have, you know, equity-focused investors, Switzerland, Scandinavia, places like that as well.
So how did the idea for ShareSite come about?
So essentially, the father and son combination. The father was an ex-accountant and a pretty keen self-directed investor. Son was sort of a software engineer type person. He's our CTO still today. And the father was tracking his portfolio in a spreadsheet, and it was just driven crazy by tabs, macros, you know.
I'm smiling, right? But there's so many guests that we've had on here that started off with a spreadsheet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And he just said to his son, you know, he said, surely there's got to be something out there that does this. And believe it or not, there's not a lot of portfolio tracking solutions out there. Most of them are tied to like a broker or an asset manager of some kind. There's not a lot of pure play investment tracking apps. And so the son sort of got started, knew a couple of developers, got them on board, and built a cloud-based platform, which at the time, you know, 10-plus years ago, was pretty revolutionary, really. Mm. There's a lot of calculation and a lot of data work that goes on behind the scenes. And to do that all in the browser was a pretty cool and new thing. Yeah.
Fantastic. So where's the business at now in terms of, you know, kind of number of employees?
So we're just on about 30 employees now. We've got a plan to scale it up to about 40. We are approaching 200,000 users around the world.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and we run a freemium model. So we try to sign up as many people as possible to the free plan. If they like it and they want to hang out there, that's cool. But if they need more functionality, they're welcome to upgrade to the premium plans as well.
So kind of typically who would your users and customers be?
Yeah, so it's kind of barbelled really. Our traditional customer, if you like, is a pretty serious self-directed investor. This is somebody who's using a couple of brokers. They may have holdings locally and abroad. They want to combine everything together. The Australian, you know, kind of prototype is a SMSF trustee looking to run their own portfolio. And you have equivalents of that in various other countries as well. But at the same time, we get a lot of attention and signups from younger investors as well.
All
so
right.
Certainly what's going on
in the
coronavirus investing world, people have just been flocking to the market and they're looking for, you know, an easy to use software solution to track their buys and sells, basically.
Just a little bit of an aside, but what have you found have been, I guess, the kind of most popular investments that you've seen through the data on your platform?
So it depends. It depends on the kind of cohort you're talking about. And we do a lot of data work. It's available in various places. But if you look at sort of the SMSF crowd, it's your traditional blue chips and your kind of your yield-bearing stocks. Although what we've seen there is that people are now gravitating overseas. So they've all kind of caught the tech bug, and they're looking to allocate themselves to Amazon, Apple, and kind of the big blue chip tech companies. But then if you sort of shift across to the younger investor side, people with sort of smaller portfolios kind of just getting started on their investment journey. A lot of that is the Afterpays, the Teslas, and sort of the newer tech companies that are out there. Which we think is quite interesting, actually, to see kind of the differences between those two investment styles.
Interesting. And so I guess, you know, the journey, you talked about being a 12-year startup. What's been some of the challenges that you've kind of faced along that to kind of get you to where you are now?
Yeah, sure. So I guess, the challenge for us has always been we bootstrapped the company in the early days, and we raised sort of smallish amounts of money. We've never done a big kind of venture-led investment round. And so in some ways that's good because it's forced us to be really disciplined and focused on revenue. But there's always been a long list of things that we want to do like straight away that we just haven't had the resource to get to, you know? So, you know, it can be hard when you're kind of, you know, when you're operating in say FinTech Australia circles or things like that, and you see some of the amounts that these companies are raising, you know, you want to do a lot of those things as well, but resources have always been a challenge for us, as I suspect they are for many companies, really.
Yeah. So when you kind of, I guess as a CEO, how do you tackle that, right? Mm. Just focusing on what's the one thing that we can do?
In a way, it's a bit clarifying because you're not kind of swimming in this sea of money where you can just be spending willy-nilly on, you know, really awesome office fit-outs or things like that. You really do need to prioritize who values the product, you know, why are they paying for it? And you've got to prioritize your software roadmap and everything you do marketing-wise from there. So it's actually a really useful clarifying message. Because one of the challenges that we also face is like we try to hire people from all different walks of life, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to hire people who've come from financial services if we can. We want to hire people who are really good with sort of digital marketing and SaaS industries. Yep. But you want to bring in all these people, but it's like at the end of the day, we are selling a portfolio administration product to self-directed investors, which isn't sort of the sexiest thing in the world, but you know, in some ways it's useful to have that clarifying message. Be like, well, people value the software and they pay for it. So that's kind of our North Star.
So it's kind of like a B2B play, but they're not B2B customers, right?
We say it's B to small B, honestly. You know, these are people maybe with a couple of million bucks that's invested. So it's a serious solution for those people and they rely on it every day.
Yeah. Yeah, so. But you're not going to get your kind of 100 users on a subscription model.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So in terms of, I guess, you know, your background, Doug, how did you get involved with ShareSight?
Yeah, so I worked for just over a decade for a company called Morningstar. They're an investment research and kind of software, kind of actually a fintech, an old school fintech company, really. And I was always very interested in kind of the intersection between software development and financial services. I saw a lot of the stuff that was available to professional investors or institutions, and I was always interested in the way that was shifting toward the retail audience. And it just so happened that the former CEO of Morningstar Australasia became a cornerstone investor in ShareSight and then brought me along to help run and invest in the business as well. So that was kind of my entree in a few years after the guys had started it.
Now, you might get in trouble for answering this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You talked there about the founders being a father and son. Yeah. I've worked for a family business before. I am a family business. It comes with some kind of nuances, should I say. What's been your kind of experience of working with a family-led business in such a fast-moving, kind of rapidly evolving, you know, environment like FinTech Wave touched on? You've got these huge capital raises, you know, and it's I can understand as a family you want to think, hey, you know, we don't want to be giving this up. We're kind of, you know, this is our family's future here. So what's it been like kind of, you know, managing those dynamics?
It's been really good.
I think we can edit this bit out, right? So.
I give those guys a ton of credit for one, accepting outside capital and allowing people like me to come in and help kind of manage the business. I mean, I came in as general manager and then was promoted to CEO. Yeah. And that was a call that I got from Tony Ryburn, the co-founder. And that was a pretty special moment. So I don't know. I always sort of remind myself that I've been entrusted with this kind of family asset in some respects. And that's a bit humbling. And at the same time, it's kind of a break on doing something really stupid because you're thinking you're kind of the steward of the business in a way. You know, you're like you said, you're not. It's not like we've raised, you know, $100 million and we're, you know, out there trying to grow at breakneck speed and you know, making tons of really expensive mistakes along the way. This is something that these guys have sort of diligently built over time that I've been entrusted to run. So, but yeah, look, I mean, they have, you know, a view as to what they want the product to be and who they want it to be for, right? And that was the original kind of use case of the product. Mm. And the product has certainly evolved to be something that plus more over time. You know, so it's led to a lot of, I would say, constructive discussions around kind of who we go after, what features do we build, how do we market the product, and things like that as well. So, yeah, I don't know. I suppose on the one hand, you know, I'm kind of looking after what sort of is and was a family business. But on the other, I can imagine if I raised a whole bunch of money from kind of the VC crowd, that would come with a whole other set of challenges. Yeah. And I'm not quite sure, you know, which one's better than the other.
Right. It's interesting, though, to see, you know, the kind of success that you've had. Particularly when I look at, you know, generally what we see with any startup, really, where you go on that fast journey of scaling up, I think where we see most of the hiring decisions go wrong in the early stages, when the founders bring in somebody like yourself, you know, especially when they're like 20, 30 people, and they think, right, you know, now it's got too big, I need to bring in somebody to manage the day-to-day. I think why it goes wrong is that they're just not ready to give that up. So it's kind of really refreshing to hear that, you know, somebody's been brought in, you know, particularly with a family business where you would think that would be held even more dear. And yet the opposite is true, that, you know, it's worked and, you know, you're there to kind of grow the business and be on that journey.
Yeah. And look, the reality of my situation is, yes, they sort of said, yeah, come on in and, you know, start taking over the general management, the sales, the marketing, the administration, that kind of thing. What we were really lucky, because Scott, the son, who is still our CTO, is a really strong technical mind. Mm. So right away, he and I kind of had that balance, sort of that yin and yang, where I'm sort of the sales and marketing guy, and he's the technical guy. And that's really worked for us very well. I think, too, we were not sort of, as I mentioned, sort of swimming in a sea of cash. Yeah. We had very, very limited budgets when I came on board, and I was only 32 at the time. Mm. So, like, I don't know. I was very sort of conscious of the fact that I was going to learn kind of as I went, and they've had a lot of patience with me, which has been really great. Excellent. So, yeah. So, in a way, not having those resources meant that there wasn't much that I could screw up, I suppose.
Well, I think there's another way to look at it as well, and you do have to become a lot more inventive, right? And I think that's, you know, I always like to use the analogy of, you know, Mission Control and NASA and how we put somebody on the moon with the things that they had at their disposal. I mean, it's just remarkable now when you think, I'm sitting here with a laptop and there's a gazillion times more power in that thing, than, you know, computing-wise, than they had in, you know, in Mission Control. And I think this is, you know, when you're forced to actually just use the resources at your disposal, it's often where the innovation comes from as well. Mm-hmm.
And you can see that in all different areas of life, right? Like, that's often why some of the funniest content out there from a humor standpoint is often stuff where you can't, you know, use obscenities and things like that, because you have to be creative to...
I think this was... this isn't my line. I think this was Vincent Turner at Uno Home Loan said, you know, when you think Twitter's forced us to all become a lot more creative... of how we put a message into 231 characters. And I think it's, we look at the things like the use of emojis, right? Would probably never have happened if we didn't have Twitter.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
We're just going to take a quick pause here, Doug, whilst I shamelessly plug my business. Getting from 1 to 100 people is the biggest challenge facing any founder or executive. Many think that raising Series A is the launch pad for success. Great, now you've got the money to hire the best tech talent. But it isn't that easy. The reality is hiring tech talent is very expensive and it's very difficult to get right. We know this because the number one complaint we hear from investors is founders blowing capital on hiring tech teams that don't deliver. That's why Tier 1 people have partnered with Patona to help fintech scale more effectively by offering a much more affordable alternative to hiring. Patona offers an outsourced tech talent solution of highly skilled remote workers. You get to hire experienced teams of developers from companies like Stripe, Square, and Visa for the cost of a senior developer here in Australia. So don't end up looking like a goose by asking investors for more cash just to pay recruiter fees. Contact me at dextertier1people.com. Well, Doug, welcome back. Wanted to have a chat with you a little bit about the culture that you're building at ShareSite. How would you describe it?
Well, we've got a culture of, I would say, technical excellence is the first thing that comes to mind. We've always been a product-led company. In the early days, it was basically Scott and a team of developers. So we're looking to bring in people, like I said before, kind of from all walks of life. But it's a pretty serious business because we're delivering a pretty serious product. You know, we're delivering a portfolio tracking solution to sort of higher net worth investors. So you know, but we'd like to bring in people from all different walks of life. And then really we want them to understand at a very, very, very detailed level our SaaS business model and then the unit economics below that so they can help grow the business.
Yeah. What does that do for the culture, having that kind of deep understanding of the actual business and how it works?
It's really helpful. For a while, I think I sort of assumed that when you brought people in, they would start to ask the questions and they'd want to sort of learn the business model themselves. But that's not always the case, especially as we've grown. But it is great because if you can get people focusing on, say, one, two, or even three things in terms of KPIs or North Stars, that really, really, really does help. And so that's what we've done. And pretty proud of kind of the balance we've built in terms of our technical excellence, as I mentioned, our investment expertise, and kind of our digital marketing prowess as well. Because we generate, you know, the signups that we enjoy, we generate most of those ourselves through digital marketing that we do natively. Yeah. So, yeah.
And, you know, big shout out to your team who I know well. They do a remarkable job and really talented people as well.
Oh, thanks very much.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that really struck me when I was talking to you about, you know, the kind of origins of the business and the ownership model. I've worked for family-owned businesses. I've got one myself as well. I always felt conscious that every time that I did something, whether it was just taking somebody out for a coffee, you know, I always had this kind of vision in my mind that I was putting my hand in the owner's pocket and literally just taking cash away from his kid's education. you know, it's kind of what that did do, though, is it created a culture where I think everybody was commercially like very astute. Mm-hmm. Have you found that you've kind of, you know, you kind of see that as well?
Absolutely, yeah. So in addition to the founders who, you know, the father is on our board, the son's our CTO, the chairman who's our largest shareholder now, everyone's really hands-on. And that's kind of the way it was in the early days. And that's shifted a bit over time as I think I've proven myself. But honestly, the way that the business is run, like with Xero and everything else, I mean, everything's visible and readily available, right? Yeah. So it's almost like there's no one's going to do that kind of stuff or get sort of too, you know, too over their skis in terms of spending money or things like that. So yeah, like it's, I mean, I'm often walking around the office asking people what this invoice was for, what that invoice was for, like, hey, try this instead, it's cheaper, that kind of thing. So it does breed that culture, which is useful.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when we see where hiring can often go wrong is typically when businesses look to scale, they go to the big end of town and bring in people from large corporates. You know, well, to them, you know, they kind of, you know, they wouldn't think anything about spending on breakfast, you know, what the year budget is for a business like ShareSite. And it's probably, you know, three or four people's wages that they've been spending on milk and coffee and tea.
Well, yeah. And what I always do is we're really clear about the cost to acquire a customer, free and paid. That's kind of our guiding light. So it's like you just spent, we could have used that money to find two more paying customers with a lifetime value of X.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a great way of putting it. You know, I've had chats with, you know, founders where I've just asked them, hey, well, what's your cost per acquisition? Yeah. And they didn't even know. Mm. Yeah. You know, and I mean, it's just remarkable, right? When you think that's the number one metric.
Well, look, I mean, you know, if I look at my own salary and I think about, do I deserve a raise?
Yeah.
And then it's like, do I deserve a raise or could I use that money to go out and find more paying customers?
Yeah.
And those are honestly the conversations I have with myself because we have that, I would say that that really disciplined, if not frugal, kind of take on things, to be honest.
How do you identify these qualities, though, at an interview stage? Because let's face it, right? It's such a rehearsed environment. Yeah. everybody's telling each other what they want to hear. You got 2 hours where you kind of ask people to give examples, but what you don't see are the actual behaviors of how they act in the environment.
I can't believe we still interview people. We as a society still interview people the way we do. I think the whole thing makes no sense.
Yeah,
like no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, mate, you're preaching to the converted.
And it's like I don't know what the answer is. Maybe it's like a real honest to goodness adoption of the probation kind of period where it's like, hey, try this and see if it works for both sides. I don't know. But what we do is we really take them on a pretty rigorous exercise in sort of a true problem or case study that we face. Yeah. And so we say, okay, our business is out there. You can sign up. It's free. Pay, go ahead and pay for it.
Yeah.
You go on the monthly plan, you can afford that certainly if you really want to work here. And then you kind of have access to the whole, the freemium journey and all the features and all the rest and our comms and marketing. So now you can present back to us what you think. And of course, that depends. Is this a technical role? Is this a marketing role? Is this a support role? But it's all out there, you know. And if someone's not willing to kind of really go to the extra mile to demonstrate that they understand the funnel, the sales funnel, then that person's probably not right for the business.
Yeah, look, I think that's kind of, we've seen the same where, the person's reaction to being asked to do something outside of the interview process is often the first indicator that it's not right. I'm not saying they're bad. Yeah. It's just this isn't the right fit.
Yeah.
And I think that the kind of one of the challenges that we see, particularly for businesses, is that they worry about losing people through the process by being that rigorous. When actually what you're doing is, quite rightly, filtering through with what I think are way more accurate measures than, as you pointed out. I always use the analogy of when I met my wife on the first date, I wasn't sitting there with a clipboard saying, can you give me an example of when you've split up with someone? If you found out somebody was cheating on you, how did you respond? Can you give me the names and numbers of two of your exes? I'll give them a call, check out you're not a bunny boy. How much do you earn?
Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, I'll let you know in a few days whether I'm interested in seeing you again.
Yeah.
And if I am, I'm going to bring along a friend and we're going to go through this all over again.
Yeah.
And after that, we'll decide whether we want to move in with each other or not.
Yeah.
I mean, you just think that person was insane, right?
Yeah.
And yet, when we're at work, we spend as much time with the people that we work with than we do with our, partner of choice. It's just incredible.
It is. I'm lucky, I guess, in the ShareSite scenario where we have a B2C product. You can see it. You can sign up to it. You can use it. And I love best when we hire people who use the product. That's always a really good indicator of how they're going to perform as an employee. But you wouldn't believe the people we hire for senior roles who don't even bother to sign up. I mean, it's absolutely like they've been, you can tell they've probably been working for one of the big four for a long time. They bounce between them. And it's like, come on.
Yeah. I remember when I was doing the or recruiting for a very high profile role about a year back, and I was literally getting smashed by bankers and people from Big Four saying, hey, I'm interested and I'm available on Friday at 9 a.m. My EA will be in touch and you can come to my office and meet me. And you think, hold on, sorry, who are you? What's this about? And it was that approach. You could tell that, hey, this isn't the right fit. When you've got a client that's all about egalitarian, you've got founders who have got, 7 years experience and have done more than that 7 years than this person's done in a 30-year career, you kind of start to think this could cause some issues.
That's also where the family being involved, the founding family being involved is still really important for us. Because it was, it was a couple of months ago where the wife and the mother was still doing our payroll, right? So you're bringing someone on at a really high wage, and the founding family is literally doing the payroll. Yeah. So it's like, you better earn this. Yeah. You better be up to this, you know? So that's a helpful check on that.
I really like this story though, Doug. And one of the reasons why is, we do a lot around culture and values, and we see businesses, particularly startups, spend so much time and waste so much money, and just like spend these week things where they get the whole team together to figure out what their culture is and what their values are. And I think it's very simple, right? as a family, as a parent, we got like three things, right? Just open and transparent with each other. Yeah. You know, we're a team. We back each other up and we, you know, we're accountable and we call out bad behavior, mm-hmm. right? That's it. Now, all the other stuff, right, it's kind of takes care of itself. But there are certain things that we all know that if we do kind of overstep the line, right, that throws the whole thing out. So you just don't go there.
Yeah.
And I think this, you know, whole thing around having a, you know, the family there, you know, one is, you know, it ensues that, you know, thing where we're all in it together. But two, I think it becomes very real. Mm. So when you've got investors, you never see them. When you've got owners there, you know, it's there. You Absolutely. Can see it.
Yeah, yeah. And it also, like I said, again, it's a good check on me. Like, I'm not this CEO who started the business, who's this kind of megalomaniac.
Yeah.
At least I hope I'm not seen that way. It's not about me. Like yeah. I said, I'm the steward here. I'm yeah. running this thing for growth and for a return
yeah.
and to provide a really good product to investors. But it's really transparent as to kind of the ownership structure and everything mm-hmm. else, right? So it's a good balance, honestly. And I don't know. The other thing too is like in a B2C technology product, SaaS product, you really can't succeed on your own. You need, like, marketer needs a software engineer to build something, right? Mm. Even all of our marketing stuff is done in-house by our developers, yeah. right? So it's such a collaborative environment that it's transparent and it's collaborative. And so if you screw up, it's pretty clear as to why you've yeah. screwed up, yeah. you know? And so, yeah, it's, yeah, I think culture comes from your kind of initial foundation. It comes from the people you hire as well, yeah. but you can't force it.
Yeah.
You know?
Now it sounds like we're kind of painting not a bleak picture here, but you know, it's not a one that, you know, you would usually see when you're going to attract talent. People go, hey, we got table tennis, we got beer pumps, we got this, we got that. You know, it's all the stuff, right? That actually, you know, what we see isn't any of the reasons why somebody joins a business, right? The type of people that you're talking about. So what would you say are the kind of, you know, the key reasons, you know, why people enjoy being at ShareSite and why they're interested in joining?
Yeah, so I think honestly, we do have some of those fun things like you mentioned, but what we emphasize is the fact that when you join ShareSite, it's not technically a flat structure, but it basically is.
Yeah.
Anybody can come talk to me about anything, like, hey, I think we should do this and here's why.
Yeah.
Or they can approach Scott or CTO and do that as well. It's a really collaborative culture in which anybody, sort of the low man of the totem pole up to the most senior people, can have a hand in the direction of the company. So I think that's pretty attractive. I would like to think anyway for talent that we're trying to hire. And also too, like we really are flexible, and we've taken an approach even pre-COVID where kind of the whole work from home thing and all that, as long as you get the work done, we don't necessarily care where you're doing it from. We trust people to be adults
yeah.
and we value their time. We hope they value our time, and we'd like to give people a large degree of flexibility. And that was something I learned back in the day working for Morningstar, where they were founded in the 1980s and they had, you know, this is financial services in the U.S. They had no dress code. They had no holiday policy at all, which in the States is like
yeah.
unheard of.
Yeah.
And it works, you know. So it kind of creates this sort of self-governing entity where if you're finding good people, they're not going to take advantage of it. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
So other than ShareSite, which other fintech has got you excited right now?
That's a good question. I'll give you two. I'll give you one. So an area that I'm really interested in personally and that I think is lacking massively in society is financial education, investor yep. education. I reflect on my own story. My dad was involved in financial services. That's how I had any kind of inkling or connection to the world. And that's, you know, in large part why I'm sitting in this chair today. I had a really captivating economics teacher in high school who ran a pretty cool sort of statewide investing competition in the States. I grew up in Chicago, so it's the state of Illinois. And those kind of things combined were just sort of serendipitous, but that, you know, otherwise there's not much education out there. So I really like the company Spriggy and what they're doing.
Well, yeah, we had Alex in the studio on Thursday.
Oh, really?
And it's yeah. actually my favorite fintech
I've met a few people from there, potentially Alex, I think somewhere along the way. This is not a, we don't have any kind of affiliation with them whatsoever, but I really like what they're doing. Because so much of the bad shit that we see in financial services is because people just don't know any better, yeah. right? And one of our favorite expressions at ShareSite is that financial services and their products are sold downwards. They're not bought,
yeah.
right? So if you're not an educated consumer and you don't know what you're paying for, you don't know what it costs or what it should yeah. cost, you're screwed.
Yeah.
So that's why I really like what they're doing. And so investor education, that's an area where, who knows, one day, like, I would love to turn my attention personally to that space.
Okay.
So, yeah.
You said there were two.
The other one is a company called Open Invest. This is a real kind of more nerdy, more kind of institutional financial plumbing. So one of the biggest problems with, I would say, portfolio tracking, wealth management administration, all the boring bits that go in behind that, is that data is not shared in financial yeah. services. There is not an API-driven ecosystem. At least there's not a legacy of one. Yeah. We're trying to change that. We've got an open API. So if anybody wants to develop against our API, please sign up and go for it. But it's that's not been the norm. And this is a company that's trying to basically create, and I'm not exactly sure of their mission statement, but it's trying to create a sort of a unified identification where it kind of brings all the investment products that are out there, particularly in the managed fund space, to all investors, right. all retail investors. So in other countries, when you buy a mutual fund or a managed fund, you can just do so through a stock market.
Like yeah.
Actually, mutual funds in the States trade on the NASDAQ and you can buy them with your broker. That's not the case in Australia. It's something that's driven me nuts for a long time, given my background at Morningstar and other yeah. places. So that's a cool company as well. And I just like that really nerdy, but really kind of picks and shovels sort of plumbing area. So
yeah. Look, I mean, if you look at where the investment's going, kind of moved from the glitz and the glamour of the neobank, and everybody's now going into the businesses like Rails Bank and Thought Machine and those that are building the plumbing and the rails and yeah. everything else behind it.
Yeah. So
great. So I guess, look, just before we wrap up, what's your general view of fintech in Australia right now?
I think it's a really collaborative, really sort of positive industry. I think what I like about FinTech Australia is that there's genuine government involvement in it as well.
Yeah.
Because coming from the States, and I won't make any political statements, but government is seen as something else.
Yeah.
it's seen as something that's often in the way or something that's trying to do something but often fails at it.
Yeah.
But here, I've been really impressed with the conversations that FinTech Australia and other companies in the fintech space have had with regulatory bodies yeah. and the government. That's really cool. That's really encouraging.
Yeah, I think we're actually the only country to have a dedicated minister for fintech.
Yeah,
as well.
I think that's right. Yeah. So I think it's great. I was struck even like logging into my own MyGov account and seeing my own tax and super information there, and yeah. I'm thinking like this would never happen in the States. Mm. It's like Australia is like so far into the future.
Yeah.
In the fintech space. So, I think more fintech, more better. I get a little skeptical sometimes when I see some of the big corporates kind of sniffing around the space a little bit.
Yeah.
And what I want for FinTech Australia, and I've said this for a long time, is I want more of a developer culture. I want more construction of stuff. I want more APIs. I want yeah. more kind of that real, real kind of emphasis yeah. on tech. I mean,
it's great that we're starting to see that through CDR and open banking.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah, it'd be great to see just, where we are in 12 months' time with that.
Yeah. Yeah, we're big proponents of open banking yeah. and we're trying to do what we can to help it out, yeah. absolutely. Yeah.
One of the great things actually with the podcast, so my cleaner, she listens to the podcast, right? Now she knows what open banking is. She's actually an investor herself, so it's highly likely she'll listen to this and trying to sign up to ShareSite, right? But it's just, I think what's incredible, right, is how you look at the stock market right now, right? And I think it's unprecedented that we'd see such economic uncertainty. And yet this, what was it? A bear run of 3 weeks, right? I mean, I really do put that down to now the accessibility yeah. that just everyday people have got.
And that goes to this interest that we have in the financial plumbing behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And it is as boring as it sounds, I promise. But like, the data accessibility and the access to opportunities, the access to good software, like I'm talking quality, I'm holding my mobile, like quality apps and services that we as consumers expect when we're, say, booking an Airbnb, that is now becoming available in investing and financial services, finally. And that opens up a whole world. I mean, there's been so much made about like, oh, all these millennials are piling into the market and they're all going nuts and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, it's because there's decent accessibility now. And there's no other alternatives. Yeah. So that's what's happening.
Yeah, well, interestingly, I remember this would go about, what, 2009, 2010. We're in the GFC and pretty much everybody that I met and we'd have a chat about where you're putting your money. It'd gone from, you know, we had pre-GFC, you'd have like 7% savings account at ING Direct, right? Yeah. And then the interest rates went down and everybody just said, hey, I'll just pay off my mortgage, right?
Exactly.
Now, millennials don't have mortgages and are unlikely to get one, right?
That's right.
So where are they going? Right? They're not going to get 7% at ING.
Yeah.
So where does it go?
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of, you know, this is again what we're seeing is just other forms of investment.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. And look, we think on balance, it's a really good thing. It's more people in the market. Hopefully, this is a learning experience for people as well.
Yeah. Well, we're going to wrap up now, but before we do, what's the future hold for ShareSite, Doug?
Yeah, so we're continuing to build out the product. We want to add more features for both the high-end investors and sort of the newbies as well. We're aggressively building out the product for other markets. So we've got kind of a long list of things we want to do for places like Singapore, Hong Kong. We're hiring about 10 more staff as well. So our growth has really been supercharged recently, thanks, quite honestly, to the interest in share markets because of COVID. So we're growing very fast and we're looking for great people and our story is by no means done. So.
Great. And where can people find out more about ShareSite?
Yeah, just go to ShareSite.com and you can sign up and use the free version for as long as you want to get a feel for what we do.
Well, Doug, thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Dexter.
And you can find me at Dexter Cousins on Twitter and Dexter Cousins on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. And if you like today's show, please subscribe to the podcast and don't forget to leave a review. It helps us bring on great guests like Doug. This show is produced by Tier 1 People. We're the leaders in FinTech executive search. We'll help you launch, scale, and innovate by delivering the right people at the right time. And you can reach us at info@tier1people.com.